This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Nicholas Carr. Nicholas is the author of The Shallows, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, as well as The Big Switch and Does It Matter? His articles and essays have appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Wired, and The New Republic, and he writes the widely read blog, Rough Type. He has been writer-in-residence at the University of California, Berkeley, and an executive editor of the Harvard Business Review. Nicholas Carr is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us, published in 2014. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you, Diane.
What was your reason for writing The Glass Cage?
I've been fascinated by the way technology influences the way we live and the way we think. And it's been the subject of a lot of my recent writing. So quickly, we've become dependent on computers and software to do all sorts of things, whether it's at work or during our personal time. We're always consulting computers or using software to get things done. And I began to do some research into what the effects of that are, good and bad, not only the practical effects on productivity and people's performance, but how it influences the way we engage with the world, the way we develop subtle talents, and generally how it kind of sets the terms, in one sense, of our existence. And so this book is the outcome of the research I did into that area.
Before we talk about some of the potential downsides of automation, in what ways does automation liberate us?
Automation, like mechanization before it during the Industrial Revolution, and you could argue like all tools from the invention of the wheel and the lever, allows us to push some of the tasks we have to do, and sometimes it's things we couldn't do on our own, over to tools or machines or, more recently, computers. And if the tools are designed well and thoughtfully and with an appreciation for how people use them and also for how people develop skills and develop talents and gain fulfillment from life, then they can be very liberating. They can actually take over routine tasks and give us the time and the mental energy and the attentiveness required to tackle harder challenges. And so I think in general, the history of technology and in the history of automation, even computer automation, has been one of great benefits, but it's not always just a story of benefits.
As humans, what do we give up when we rely too much on automation?
We give up a couple of things. The scholars of automation, the people who have researched it deeply, see that when people rely on computers, instead of doing things themselves, they often fall victim to what's called automation complacency. And that means if you know that the software is going to handle things for you, you begin to tune out. You begin to lose situational awareness. You begin to kind of let your mind wander. And that has a couple effects. One thing is that if you're suddenly called upon to perform the function you're supposed to be doing, you can mess up because you're not aware of what's going on. And suddenly, if the technology fails or you run into circumstances where you really need the human touch and human expertise, people show a proclivity to make errors, and often quite dangerous errors if they're in risky situations. But more than that, I think it does a couple of things that diminish the quality of our lives. One thing is it makes it harder to both develop talent and to exercise talent because you're kind of offloading everything interesting, it turns out, onto the machines. And that, particularly over the long run, can diminish our sense of fulfillment and satisfaction, which we tend to get by struggling with hard challenges and overcoming them. And also, it removes us from the world. We spend more time looking at screens, you know, staring into our smartphone or into our tablet or whatever, and less time physically and mentally engaged with the richness of the world. And that, too, I think, can diminish the quality and richness of our lives.
Would you say more about how our mental processes are different when we use automation as opposed to when we carry out a task for ourselves?
Psychologists and other people who study human learning in skill development have discovered something they call the generation effect. And what that means is pretty simple, and I think once you hear it, you'll know intuitively that it's correct. But the generation effect simply means that when we are actively engaged in some task, some activity, and it can be an intellectual activity, it can be one of manual skill. When we're actively engaged, we learn more, we gain more satisfaction than when we're more passive, than we're just observing. And you see this in the educational sphere. If you get a child actively involved in some aspect of learning, they'll learn more, they'll remember more, they'll retain more than if you just present the information in a book or on a screen. And unfortunately, when we move to a reliance on computers, what often happens is you lose the generation effect. More and more, if you look at how people work, how people live, they're engaged less actively with particular tasks, whether it's, you know, finding your way around a city. Instead of doing that actively, you kind of let the GPS unit direct you, or many other things. We lose the benefits of the generation effect. We become observers rather than actors.
In what ways does automation narrow our perspective and limit our choices?
One of the things I get into in The Glass Cage toward the end is something beyond the question of talent development and engagement with the world. It's what happens when the tools we use are kind of designed and operate in ways that are hidden from us. And if you think about software today, you know, whether it's a social networking software or a mapping software or something you use in your professional job, you're often being guided by algorithms, by code that you don't really know, you don't really have a deep understanding of how it operates. And what that means is that often you are at the beck and call, in a way, of the writers of the software. So your intentions become subsumed into the intentions of the software writer who is governing the processes you go through. And in the context of companies, of information companies like Google or Facebook, it's even governing the information you see. And so one of the dangers here is a danger of manipulation. This isn't to say that these companies might not be entirely benign and helpful in what they set out to do, but nevertheless, you're following the procedures that fit their view of the task and their view of the world and even their business motives. And because we don't know how the software works, it's hidden from us, it's very hard to know when we're being manipulated and when we're actually acting on our own volition.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Nicholas Carr, author of the book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's talk now about some specific examples. In your book, you talk about some of the downsides of using automation in aviation. Would you speak about that?
Aviation is a place, the airline industry, where computers have been taking over functions of pilots for many years, since at least the 1970s. And therefore, it gives a very good, there's been a lot of studies of this. So if you want to know how we interact with computers, the place to start is aviation. And in general, the story of automation in aviation, whether it's autopilots or more recent tools, is a very happy story. We've made flying much, much safer, and automation seems to play a role in that. There's other things like aircraft design and training and so forth, but automation is important. But more recently, what we've started to see is that the automated systems, which now encompass all sorts of things, you know, not just keeping the plane steady, but plotting a flight plan and so forth, has taken over so much of the duties and activities of pilots that pilots spend very, very little time actually manually flying the plane. And in the worst case situation, what happens is they fall victim to that automation complacency. They lose situational awareness, particularly on long flights. And at those times when the technology fails, and it does fail from time to time, they have to suddenly take over, often in very dangerous circumstances, and sometimes they make mistakes. So it's not that automation is bad in aviation. The point isn't that we want to go back, but the point is that as we move forward, we need to recognize that some amount of automation may be very good, but then if you add even more and remove more of the control and responsibility from the human being, you may actually start having counterproductive effects. You might start losing efficiency, losing safety. And so as we turn over more and more activities, human activities, to computers, we have to be very careful about how we set limits on automation and also how we design the systems.
Would you speak about what you call automation bias and how it can affect medical care?
Automation bias is another aspect that goes along with automation complacency. And basically, it means that we human beings tend to have a huge amount of trust in our computers. And as a result, we'll tend to take any information coming from a computer screen as kind of the gospel truth, even if our own senses tell us otherwise. We'll believe the computer. And this can distort a lot of people's decisions. You see it with truck drivers using GPS, for instance, and they'll run into bridges because they're just blindly following the GPS instructions. But we're also starting to see it in medicine, where software is playing a much, much bigger role. Computers are playing a much bigger role. And I give the example of a radiologist reading X-ray images or other diagnostic images. And today, they often are aided by software that highlights areas on the image that look suspicious based on the history of how these things work. And in many cases, that can be a very good thing, that it focuses radiologists' attention on those particular areas, and they may discover things that they would have missed. In other cases, studies show, it has the opposite effect. The doctor becomes so fixated on the area that's highlighted that he or she may miss other things going on elsewhere in the image. And in fact, the most recent research suggests that these software programs seem to help in fairly easy cases, but they can actually get in the way of doctors in harder cases, harder images to read. So here we see how even in systems that you'd think would just be all to the good, our bias to kind of be led by the computer and just to believe what the computer's telling us can get in the way, can kind of short circuit our own attentiveness and our own intuition and expertise.
Another form of automation in the healthcare system has been the use of electronic medical records. How have electronic medical records influenced our healthcare system?
Well, one thing so far, they haven't lived up to their promise. The government has spent something like $30 billion in recent years to subsidize doctors and hospitals in making the shift from paper records to electronic records. And the assumption was that this would pay off with lots of cost savings, better quality of care, and of course it would better enable doctors to share information on patients. And in all the cases, we're not seeing that kind of payoff. There are indications actually that costs might go up when you shift to electronic records. And I'll give you an example. Everybody believed that if doctors could call up old tests, blood tests, images, or whatever, on their computer while in an exam, then they would order fewer tests. In fact, the research shows that the opposite happens. When doctors assume it'll be easy to order tests and get the results quickly on their computers, they actually end up ordering more tests, and the quality of care doesn't go up. It's just the cost goes up, so it's more unnecessary tests often. And then we see, when it comes to the quality of care, there are some instances where you see improvement. If a patient has a chronic condition that requires lots of different doctors, the electronic records may improve the care. In other cases, you see that the computer can get in the way of the doctor-patient relationship. If you've gone into a doctor for an exam or a physical recently and the doctor is using a computer of some sort, what you find often is that, as one medical professor puts it, there's suddenly a third person, third party in the room with you. And studies show that doctors will look at the computer about 25 to 50% of the time during the exam. And neither the doctors nor the patients tend to be happy about this situation. It does kind of make the experience less intimate. So what we learn from electronic medical records is that often automation in general has very different effects than we expect. It can change the behavior of the person using it in ways that are very subtle and yet that have big effects. And again, the point isn't that we're going to all go back to paper records. The point is that we have to be very careful in designing these systems, and we have to take into account how they can have negative effects as well as positive ones, and try to maintain a respect for human skill and human intuition and human expertise, even as we roll out the computer systems.
You've alluded a bit to this, but what are some of the consequences of relying on GPS for wayfinding?
One of the most obvious ways that computers have displaced some of our own skills is our reliance on GPS systems or mapping systems on smartphones to get around. And these can be a huge, huge boon. If you're in a hurry and you need to get somewhere quickly, it's very easy to turn on the GPS and get directions. Or if you're lost, there's nothing like a computer to help you find your way again. But here too, we find that very, very quickly, we become completely reliant on the system. So people don't just use them when they face a tough navigational challenge, they use them all the time. You go out the door, you turn on Google Maps or whatever, and you know, you get led through a city or a countryside or whatever. And what happens is you begin to lose your own navigational sense. And, you know, we can debate how valuable the navigational sense is, but I would argue that having a sense of place, knowing how to get around, does have intrinsic benefits. And what we're also learning is that our navigational sense seems to be closely related to the strength of our memory in general. These seem to come from the same brain systems. So some doctors, some medical researchers are nervous that if we don't exercise our navigational sense, if we don't actually learn to get around on our own, we may suffer some long-term consequences for memory that could be debilitating. So I think we have to, again, respect the human talents for navigation, because these are talents that have developed over millennia and are actually maybe much more important to us than we assume.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Nicholas Carr, author of the book The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. What are the dangers of replacing people with robots?
One of the dangers is, of course, you can lose a lot of jobs very quickly. And the history of industrial technology, business technology, is one that teaches us that usually when a new technology comes along and displaces some jobs, as machines displaced a lot of craft people during the Industrial Revolution, the increase in productivity ends up creating lots more jobs. So you gain more jobs than you lose. With robotics and with the other computer systems, so far we're not seeing that same dynamic play out. We're automating and losing more and more jobs, both through the use of robots and related things in factories and other industrial settings, but also the use of software in many white-collar jobs, professional jobs. We're starting to displace a lot of workers, but we haven't seen the big new categories of jobs emerge, middle-class, good-paying, stable middle-class jobs, the way we saw in the last century when you had an explosion in white-collar work and professional work, even as machines were taking over some of the industrial production work. And a lot of economists now are concerned that we've kind of created a new dynamic in the economy, which is going to make it harder and harder for us to sustain a vibrant and healthy middle class. So one of the things we need to worry about is the economic effects of massive automation using computers and robotics today.
What are some of the ethical challenges in handing over decision-making to machines?
This is an area that we haven't thought much about, but I think we're going to have to think about very quickly. You know, there are breakthroughs going on in developing self-driving cars, magnificent engineering achievements. And there's also, you know, fast progress, for instance, in warfare, creating planes or even robotic soldiers that can fight in battles. And what happens as we begin to create robots that can actually act autonomously in the world, whether it's a car or whether it's a robotic soldier, these machines are going to come up against, they're going to have to make difficult ethical decisions, just like all of us have to do from time to time when we're going through the world. So, you know, if you have a completely autonomous car, eventually it's going to have to make a decision. For instance, if a pet, a dog or something runs out in front of it, is it going to hit the dog? Is it going to go off the road? Is it going to, you know, put the driver at risk in order to save the animal? There's all sorts of those kind of decisions. And obviously in warfare, if you start having robots making decisions about whether to fire or not, it becomes much more pressing. But what that means is, in order to do this, we have to program ethical codes, moral codes, into the robot. And we're not very good at determining for ourselves all the time what is the best choice when we have to make a choice between two evils or two wrongs. So the question is, how do we go about coding ethics into an inanimate machine, and whose ethics are they? Who gets to make these moral decisions? In the case of cars, is it the car owner? Is it the software writers? Is it the government? Is it the insurance company? Because all of those parties would take different views of these things. So we're rushing ahead to create robots that can act on their own in the world, but we haven't really had any discussion about the ethical and moral hazards of this development.
What is the optimal relation of humans to machine? How can they most productively interact?
I think the dominant design philosophy in automation today is what's called technology-centered design, where the designer or the programmer asks, what can the computer do? And then all those tasks are given to the computer, and then what's left over goes to the human being. And what's left over tends to be things we're not very good at, like monitoring screens and taking over suddenly in emergencies. A better way, I think, a more productive and more humane and humanistic way, is to follow an approach called human-centered design, where you first say, what are people good at? Because we tend to underestimate our own skills and talents, and actually, you know, we're much better than robots at thinking creatively, at thinking conceptually and critically. And so you begin by saying, what are humans good at, and how can we use the computer or the robot or whatever to aid the human being, to fill in, you know, the flaws in our thinking or the limitations in our physical capabilities? And through that method, I think you end up with systems and software that get the best out of both parties, get the best out of the person and get the best out of the computer. And in the years ahead, as we do more and more things with computers, it's very important that we continue to remember that both of these, the technology and the people, both have things they're good at and things they're not good at. And our goal should be to get the best of both parties without limiting the human skills and human capabilities that remain so important to us personally, but also to our society.
What most stands in the way of gaining a more favorable balance between humans and machine?
A couple of things, and unfortunately, they're hard things to overcome. One is that we have within us, as individuals, a kind of instinct that tells us that we want to offload effort and challenge to machines whenever possible. So if a new software app comes along that says, I'll take over this aspect of your life, we tend to say, sure, take it over, because we think we'll be happier if we're not challenged as much and if we're not making as big an effort, even though it turns out when you look at what really makes us fulfilled and happy and satisfied, it's when we're working hard, when we're struggling with some challenge, when we're exercising our skills. So there's the personal side, and then there's kind of the commercial business side. Companies automate processes in order to reduce their dependence on people, in order to save time, save money, and make things more efficient. And often that means relegating the human beings to a subservient and marginal role in order to save a few extra pennies. And over the long run, I think that those short-term gains in efficiency can actually be overwhelmed by the unexpected effects of losing human talent and human expertise. But nevertheless, as everybody knows, there's this very strong desire to make everything as productive and as efficient as possible, and that tends to push tasks away from humans and into computers.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
As all of us rush to do more and more things through computers, what I'm hoping to do is simply give people pause to realize that some of our desires here actually get in the way of the richness of our experience of life. And this is beyond the practical business concerns. This is about, the way I like to explain it is that technology, through the tools we design and use, we're constantly renegotiating the terms of our relationship to the world, the terms of our experience. And we need to be very, very careful in doing that, particularly today as progress goes forward so quickly. We need to be careful that we don't end up sacrificing things that are really essential to our well-being, to our happiness, to our fulfillment. And I fear that with computer automation, that is actually what's happening today.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Think before pulling your smartphone out and following the advice it provides, because there are times when actually struggling with a challenge, using your own wits, using your own physical body to accomplish things is actually going to make you more satisfied, happier, more fulfilled than simply becoming a person who follows what their screen tells them to do.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Nicholas Carr, author of the book The Glass Cage, Automation and Us, published in 2014 by W.W. Norton & Company. For more information, check on the web at nicholascarr.com. Again, that's NICHOLASCARR.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.